From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In just a few minutes, or moments at this point, President Bush will address the nation on Iraq and the imminent prospect of war. We will go to the White House as soon as the president is at the microphone to carry his speech live and in full. Then we'll return to the On Point studio for full analysis and your calls. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said earlier today that the president will deliver an ultimatum tonight, that Saddam Hussein must leave Iraq or face U.S.-led military action. President Bush is expected to brace the American people for that action, that war, in his remarks tonight. It has been a fast-paced 48 hours for the president and his administration. He met with the leaders of Britain and Spain mid-Atlantic on Sunday in the Azores, then returned with a cascade of steps appearing to clear the way for war. The U.S., Britain, and Spain today withdrew a draft U.N. resolution that they had hoped would give fresh Security Council authorization for war. Washington could not muster a Security Council majority for the resolution. Secretary of State Colin Powell expressed regret at that this morning, but asserted that earlier U.N. resolutions laid sufficient legal groundwork for war. There were many signs on many fronts today that war is now imminent. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan ordered U.N. staff in Iraq, including weapons inspectors and relief workers, to leave the country. Embassy staffs and many journalists are leaving Baghdad. We now see the president's podium prepared. He's at the podium.
For more than a decade, the United States and other nations have pursued patient and honorable efforts to disarm the Iraqi regime without war. That regime pledged to reveal and destroy all its weapons of mass destruction as a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War in 1991. Since then, the world has engaged in 12 years of diplomacy. We have passed more than a dozen resolutions in the United Nations Security Council. We have sent hundreds of weapons inspectors to oversee the disarmament of Iraq. Our good faith has not been returned. The Iraqi regime has used diplomacy as a ploy to gain time and advantage. It has uniformly defied Security Council resolutions demanding full disarmament. Over the years, UN weapon inspectors have been threatened by Iraqi officials, electronically bugged, and systematically deceived. Peaceful efforts to disarm the Iraqi regime have failed again and again because we are not dealing with peaceful men. Intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraqi regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised. This regime has already used weapons of mass destruction against Iraq's neighbors and against Iraq's people. The regime has a history of reckless aggression in the Middle East. It has a deep hatred of America and our friends, and it has aided, trained, and harbored terrorists, including operatives of Al-Qaeda. The danger is clear. Using chemical, biological, or one-day nuclear weapons obtained with the help of Iraq, the terrorists could fulfill their stated ambitions and kill thousands or hundreds of thousands of innocent people in our country or any other. The United States and other nations did nothing to deserve or invite this threat, but we will do everything to defeat it. Instead of drifting along toward tragedy, we will set a course toward safety. Before the day of horror can come, before it is too late to act, this danger will be removed. The United States of America has the sovereign authority to use force in assuring its own national security. That duty falls to me as Commander-in-Chief by the oath I have sworn, by the oath I will keep. Recognizing the threat to our country, the United States Congress voted overwhelmingly last year to support the use of force against Iraq. America tried to work with the United Nations to address this threat because we wanted to resolve the issue peacefully. We believe in the mission of the United Nations. One reason the UN was founded after the Second World War was to confront aggressive dictators actively and early before they can attack the innocent and destroy the peace. In the case of Iraq, the Security Council did act in the early 1990s under resolutions 678 and 687, both still in effect. The United States and our allies are authorized to use force in ridding Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. This is not a question of authority. It is a question of will. Last September, I went to the UN General Assembly and urged the nations of the world to unite and bring an end to this danger. On November 8th, the Security Council unanimously passed Resolution 1441. Finding Iraq in material breach of its obligations and vowing serious consequences if Iraq did not fully and immediately disarm. Today, no nation can possibly claim that Iraq has disarmed, and it will not disarm so long as Saddam Hussein holds power. For the last 4.5 months, the United States and our allies have worked within the Security Council to enforce that Council's long-standing demands. Yet some permanent members of the Security Council have publicly announced they will veto any resolution that compels the disarmament of Iraq. These governments share our assessment of the danger, but not our resolve to meet it. Many nations, however, do have the resolve and fortitude to act against this threat to peace. And a broad coalition is now gathering to enforce the just demands of the world. The United Nations Security Council has not lived up to its responsibilities, so we will rise to ours. In recent days, some governments in the Middle East have been doing their part. They have delivered public and private messages urging the dictator to leave Iraq so that disarmament can proceed peacefully. He has thus far refused. All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing. For their own safety, all foreign nationals, including journalists and inspectors, should leave Iraq immediately. Many Iraqis can hear me tonight in a translated radio broadcast, and I have a message for them. If we must begin a military campaign, it will be directed against the lawless men who rule your country and not against you. As our coalition takes away their power, we will deliver the food and medicine you need. We will tear down the apparatus of terror, and we will help you to build a new Iraq that is prosperous and free. In a free Iraq, there will be no more wars of aggression against your neighbors, no more poison factories, no more executions of dissidents, no more torture chambers and rape rooms. The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near. It is too late for Saddam Hussein to remain in power. It is not too late for the Iraqi military to act with honor and protect your country by permitting the peaceful entry of coalition forces to eliminate weapons of mass destruction. Our forces will give Iraqi military units clear instructions on actions they can take to avoid being attacked and destroyed. I urge every member of the Iraqi military and intelligence services, if war comes, do not fight for a dying regime that is not worth your own life. And all Iraqi military and civilian personnel should listen carefully to this warning. In any conflict, your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells, a source of wealth that belongs to the Iraqi people. Do not obey any command to use weapons of mass destruction against anyone, including the Iraqi people. War crimes will be prosecuted. War criminals will be punished. And it will be no defense to say, I was just following orders. Should Saddam Hussein choose confrontation, The American people can know that every measure has been taken to avoid war, and every measure will be taken to win it. Americans understand the cost of conflict because we have paid them in the past. War has no certainty except the certainty of sacrifice. Yet the only way to reduce the harm and duration of war is to apply the full force and might of our military, and we are prepared to do so. If Saddam Hussein attempts to cling to power, he will remain a deadly foe until the end. In desperation, he and terrorist groups might try to conduct terrorist operations against the American people and our friends. These attacks are not inevitable. They are, however, possible. And this very fact underscores the reason we cannot live under the threat of blackmail. The terrorist threat to America and the world will be diminished the moment that Saddam Hussein is disarmed. Our government is on heightened watch against these dangers. Just as we are preparing to ensure victory in Iraq, we are taking further actions to protect our homeland. In recent days, American authorities have expelled from the country certain individuals with ties to Iraqi intelligence services. Among other measures, I have directed additional security at our airports and increased Coast Guard patrols of major seaports. The Department of Homeland Security is working closely with the nation's governors to increase armed security at critical facilities across America. Should enemies strike our country, they would be attempting to shift our attention with panic and weaken our morale with fear. In this, they would fail. No act of theirs can alter the course or shake the resolve of this country. We are a peaceful people, yet we're not a fragile people, and we will not be intimidated by thugs and killers. If our enemies dare to strike us, they and all who have aided them will face fearful consequences. We are now acting because the risks of inaction would be far greater. In 1 year or 5 years, the power of Iraq to inflict harm on all free nations would be multiplied many times over. With these capabilities, Saddam Hussein and his terrorist allies could choose the moment of deadly conflict when they are strongest. We choose to meet that threat now, where it arises, before it can appear suddenly in our skies and cities. The cause of peace requires all free nations to recognize new and undeniable realities. In the 20th century, some chose to appease murderous dictators whose threats were allowed to grow into genocide and global war. In this century, when evil men plot chemical, biological, and nuclear terror, a policy of appeasement could bring destruction of a kind never before seen on this earth. Terrorists and terrorist states do not reveal these threats with fair notice in formal declarations. And responding to such enemies only after they have struck first is not self-defense. It is suicide. The security of the world requires disarming Saddam Hussein now. As we enforce the just demands of the world, we will also honor the deepest commitments of our country. Unlike Saddam Hussein, we believe the Iraqi people are deserving and capable of human liberty. And when the dictator has departed, they can set an example to all the Middle East of a vital and peaceful and self-governing nation. The United States, with other countries, will work to advance liberty and peace in that region. Our goal will not be achieved overnight, but it can come over time. The power and appeal of human liberty is felt in every life and every land. And the greatest power of freedom is to overcome hatred and violence and turn the creative gifts of men and women to the pursuits of peace. That is the future we choose. Free nations have a duty to defend our people by uniting against the violent. And tonight, as we have done before, America and our allies accept that responsibility. Good night, and may God continue to bless America.
President George W. Bush addressing the nation from the White House tonight, laying down an ultimatum for Saddam Hussein and his sons, saying they have 48 hours to leave Iraq, advising all foreign nationals and journalists to leave Iraq, saying that after that 48 hours, the United States will, at the time of its own choosing and with the allies that it brings to the table, be ready and free to commence military action. It was a stern speech, the president very sober-faced throughout, warning the Iraqi military that they will face their own problems if they are involved in resisting a U.S. Invading force, if they should burn oil, destroy oil wells, if they should use weapons of mass destruction. He warned Iraq's military that war crimes will be prosecuted. The president spoke directly to the Iraqi people in the midst of his speech, saying that the United States will stand up for liberty and peace in Iraq with its allies. The kind of speech that tells a defined enemy that war is coming and tells the American people to prepare and be ready, including some very clear messages to Americans about potential risks at home of terrorist attack during what now appears to be an imminent war, in any case, but the case in which Saddam Hussein and his sons leave that country, which all analysts have to this point described as an unlikely development. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at MIT and author of Causes of War, Power, and the Roots of Conflict. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Evra.
Thanks for having me.
By Ted Olstrom, retired Air Force general, now director of national security programs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was executive officer to the commander at the U.S. military headquarters in Europe during the 1991 Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, General Olstrom.
Nice to be here.
By William Crystal, editor of the conservative Weekly Standard magazine and co-author of the new book, The War Over Iraq. William Crystal, welcome back from last hour.
Thanks, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, by our on-point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
Stephen Van Evra, we've spoken often over this last year and more about the long road to where we find ourselves tonight. You listened to the president's speech along with all the rest of us. Your first thoughts?
I thought he gave the best case he could for war, and I can't see any way we aren't going to war in the next few days unless two very unlikely scenarios happen. One is that the Iraqi military do take his invitation to overthrow Saddam, in which case we still aren't out of the woods because we then have to sort things out with the Iraqi military.
Mm-hmm.
And, simply having Saddam out is not enough to make us happy. We need to have access to their weapons of mass destruction, and we need a new regime that looks like one that we're happy with. Or option two is that Saddam takes us up on this invitation to leave, which I think the chances are about zero of that. So I think we're heading for war, maybe not Wednesday, but in the next few days.
And Tad Olstrom, you've been there as a general. How do you imagine that these words fall on the ears of American military commanders this evening?
Well, I do believe that our troops are, number one, they're ready. They're probably a little antsy as well because they've been there for a significant amount of time. It's a very easy transition in my mind for the commanders to take the words of the commander-in-chief and turn that into action.
William Crystal, you have been part of the group that has encouraged Washington to be tough with Baghdad. Is this the toughness that that camp has longed for, wished for? Is it now coming to pass?
It is, and it's a very bold, I think historians will be struck by the boldness of President Bush. I applaud it and admire it, but one can't deny that he's doing something bold. I was structuring the speech by two things. I mean, both asking implicitly the Iraqi military to overthrow Saddam, but also explicitly urging them to basically lay down their arms and permit the American military a peaceful entry. I mean, they have been doing extensive psychological operations, I think, towards the Iraqi military. It'll be interesting to see over the next 48 hours, let alone after that, whether we start to see serious defections from the Iraqi military, especially outside the inner circle of the Republican Guard near Baghdad and Tikrit. The other thing is I was in the Bush, the White House in the first Gulf War. I remember that President Bush's speech. Mm-hmm. We all remember, I think, President Clinton's speech when we launched hostilities in Bosnia and Kosovo. I think this is the first speech by an American president in our lifetime where he addressed, where he had to warn Americans of the possibility of an attack on the homeland, which is really a start, I think, brings home in a very startling way this new post-9/11 era we live in.
Jack Beatty, it was clear that the president, we just have a few seconds before the break, but clearly he felt the necessity to speak to that issue.
Yes, we are vulnerable, and our wars have been sort of free in that respect, but not now. This is the new 21st century reality.
Listeners, we're talking about the president's address to the nation tonight. He has laid down an ultimatum for Saddam Hussein and his sons, 48 hours, and after that, war when the president chooses. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. What do you make of the president's speech? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Just a few moments ago, President Bush concluded an address to the nation and an address to the Iraqi people, or at least as many of them and the Iraqi military as may hear it, laying down an ultimatum, a final ultimatum, it is clear, for Saddam Hussein and his sons, he said, to leave Iraq within 48 hours, saying that the United States would be prepared at the time of its choosing after that 48 hours to commence hostilities, in effect, to attack Iraq. We're talking about the president's speech tonight, its implications, and the path ahead for Iraq, for the United States, for the U.S. military. My guests tonight are General Tad Olstrom, retired Air Force general, now director of the National Security Programs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at MIT, William Kristol, editor of the conservative Weekly Standard magazine and co-author of the new book, The War Over Iraq, and our own Jack Beatty. Jack, the president said instead of drifting along toward tragedy, we will act to ensure safety.
Yes, he did. And he talked about the he indirectly addressed the safety of the Iraqi people when he said, this isn't against you. It's against the lawless men who rule you. And yet I couldn't help but wonder about that. The Pope has called this war a defeat for humanity. And he's called it that because of the inevitability of possible heavy civilian loss of life. And, you know, we're going to drop 3,000 bombs and rockets in 48 hours. Suppose one civilian is killed for each one of those people. And that's just the number we lost on September 11th. And suppose the New York Times tomorrow were to do a big takeout with biographies of all these people, those lovely little stories that made us cry, and we read about all these Iraqi people who are going to die. What would we do? Would we say with the president that we have taken every step to avoid war? I don't think so. We would demand steps short of war if we looked at those people, if we knew those stories.
General Olstrom, civilian casualties. The U.S. military is highly attuned to them for all kinds of reasons, not least political reasons. It's bad, never mind the moral side that Jack is pointing out. It doesn't sell well at all. What about it? How great is the risk? How bloodless in the civilian sector can this, could this attack be when it comes?
We have become accustomed to very few civilian casualties in comparison to most of the wars that we have fought. As the chairman has said, and so has the Secretary of Defense on more than one occasion, that there's an expectation that there will be civilian casualties, even with as many as the preventative measures that are being taken by our air crews and by our planners.
As the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
That's correct. And the fact is that there will be civilian casualties, and they will get a lot of media attention. But I think we'll have to go back and take a look and see how accurate these particular strikes are, and they will be very accurate. Many of the targets, certainly initially, are going to be military targets. I don't even see civilian targets on a target list, in my viewpoint at this time. We certainly are going to go to military targets. The inevitability of having civilians at these military targets, indeed, will be there.
Jack Beatty puts out a hypothetical, one civilian per each of the 3,000 missiles at the start of war. Does that add up to you as a military man?
No, it doesn't add up to me at all, since I know that a number of those targets will be pure military targets, and that we can assume that if they're military targets, the people that are at that target will indeed be military or direct military related.
Stephen Van Evra,
one point on that.
Bill Kristol,
really, I mean, Jack's all upset about that. I mean, Look, whatever you think of this war and whether it's wise or not, no one can accuse President Bush of taking the cowardly way out, which is to precisely just bomb the hell out of this country and not send over troops to occupy it, to remove the regime, to put Americans at risk, 225,000 of them and 30,000 British troops. I mean, we ran a war in 1999 in Kosovo where we bombed from 15,000 feet. We inflicted some civilian casualties and we put virtually no Americans at risk. President Bush could have done that. That's what Bill Clinton did in Iraq in 1998. Whatever you think of the war, it's really unfair, I think, to imply that President Bush is putting American troops there. He's going for regime change. The easy way out would be to say, and in fact many doves have said this, well, we can just selectively bomb these weapons of mass destruction sites and kind of repeatedly bomb Iraq. Why are we going for an invasion? So I think President Bush is doing it in a way that minimizes civilian casualties, and particularly Iraqi civilian casualties.
Stephen Venever, you're very attuned to the broader security implications of war with Iraq. We've talked about this in the past, about how all this will be received. Jack's concerned about civilian casualties. William Crystal says steps have been taken to minimize those, including putting U.S. soldiers in harm's way. How do you expect, in the way that this now impending war, it appears, is being presented, being packaged, it will be received in the region as it unfolds?
I think it's crucial that that it appear to the Arab and Muslim world that we're waging this war in as humane a way as we can. That means that we have to do our best to avoid civilian casualties, and I do expect that we will kill far fewer civilians than historically we've seen in warfare, probably in the very low thousands. But it further requires that we be able to convince people that we've done our very best to avoid civilian casualties. No one expects us to kill nobody, but the mm-hmm. world expects us to try hard, and we need to actually try hard not to kill civilians and explain that repeatedly to the world. Second thing is we need to look sorry when we do kill civilians, and we've been rather bad about that in the past. There needs to be some kind of ritual way in which the U.S. government looks as unhappy about the death of innocent civilians in war as we look about the death of our own people, and we haven't been good about this in the past. We should apologize to the loved ones of those we kill. We should do it face-to-face. And then thirdly, people are going to measure the civilian casualties against the benefit that Iraqis see to removing Saddam. And I am expecting to see dancing in the streets in Baghdad. This guy is a monstrous dictator. He's murdered 400,000 to 500,000 of his own people over the last 23 years. And the world's going to measure the pain of removing him against the benefit. And so we should remember we're going to see, two things during this war. At the beginning, civilians hurt. At the end, civilians who are going to be very glad. And then the long-run task we face is to keep those civilians sounding glad. We need to then run an occupation that the world concludes fairly has been better for Iraq than the alternative. And that's not going to be easy.
William Crystal, I know we have to let you go in just a minute. The president spoke directly to the American people about the terror threat that he indicated would be attendant to this war. That we should be prepared for the psychological impact of an attack if one should come in the United States or in the country of an ally. Do you think that Americans are prepared for that? Can any people be prepared for such a thing? If there were some equivalent or counterpart to a 9/11 style attack in the midst of war, what impact?
That's awfully hard to say, obviously. I mean, I think the president is right to warn about it. I think the president has been pretty sober and responsible in general and not sugarcoating this war, either in terms of, Steve says, of Iraqi civilian casualties, of the threats to Americans at home, of the fact that we're putting an awful lot of American young men and women in harm's way. This war, it could be, you never know with war. It could be tough and it could be easy. I think the plea to the Iraqi military, that's really worth following in the next day or two. I mean, can we actually stimulate massive defections and laying down of arms? If we have an unimpeded entry into the country for at least a while, then Saddam can think, well, he's got his Republican Guard pulled up near Baghdad and Tikrit. But I don't know. I mean, the psychology of American troops basically walking, driving into the country without having to fight their way in could be pretty devastating, I should think, even for the more loyal troops closer in. So that would be the best case. But look, the worst case obviously would be that Saddam could use chemical and biological weapons on us, on Iraqis. But Saddam has killed an awful lot of Iraqis. And if we're really to be concerned about civilian casualties, I just absolutely agree with Steve. We need to weigh in the balance the deaths he is responsible for with the deaths we will be responsible for.
William Crystal, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
William Crystal is editor of the Weekly Standard and co-author of the new book, The War Over Iraq. But a lot of callers want to join the conversation. I guess we should turn to them. Andrew's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. If we had acted to remove Saddam Hussein before the Iran-Iraq war, how many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Iranians would we have saved then versus the limited casualties that a U.S.-style war that we are planning would save? And to the argument of containment as an option to war, the idea that if we just keep enough troops in the desert standing there ready to go in case he acts, the way we did with the Soviet Union, I think is a non-starter, because in recent years we've discovered that containment wasn't terribly effective against the Soviet Union, and maybe not effective against closed societies.
Of course, Andrew, I guess it bears pointing out that we were not removing Saddam Hussein from power during before the Iran-Iraq war.
I was posing it as a hypothetical.
Well, yes, but I mean the facts are important here. We were actually helping him hold power and helped him during that war. Does that give you pause now as you think about Washington installing a new government in Iraq, given that history?
Yes, it does. But consider that if we leave the current regime in power and he launches another war, such as the Iran-Iraq war, against his neighbors, it would be difficult for him to launch a direct war against us, not unless he borrows some of those long-range missiles from Kim Jong-il.
Yeah, we've got it, and their range is growing. Andrew, thank you for your call. General Ulstrom, how about it? In the military, we've been talking this hour and before about containment tonight. From a military point of view, is invasion preferable to containment? Would either work? Is this a political decision or, in military terms, a strategic decision?
I think it's both a military and certainly a strategic decision, a political decision. The answer is that the military is an arm of the government, and one of the things the military can do is containment. It would not be one of those things that you would find great support for a large force to be stationed in the Middle East for the sake of containment, but I suspect that was also true at the end of World War II.
But is containment still, in military terms, a viable option in a period where weapons of mass destruction can be smuggled around the world in a suitcase?
In this particular case, I agree with the administration that the WMD threat is one that needs to be treated. It needs to be treated now. And waiting for a containment policy to work when there is a threat of WMD spreading around the world, and the intelligence sources, I believe, are giving the administration the information they need to say that the threat is high enough, that action is required now.
We should note that the terror threat in the United States has been raised to high within the last few minutes to the orange level again. General Ted Ulstrom, I want to ask you also about the point that President Bush raised and we've spoken to this evening about his explicit call out to the Iraqi military to, A, not pull the trigger on anything, not to fire the oil wells, not to use weapons of mass destruction, not to commit what he called war crimes, but also to, he said, if war comes, do not fight for a dying regime. He's encouraging them to lay down their arms. A lot of Iraqi troops did just that in the first Gulf War. Is it fair to anticipate that we will see that again? Do we have intelligence to suggest that it might happen? Or is it just a roll of the dice to see what happens on that front?
Well, I think it's fair to say that that's an expectation that we'll see a considerable amount of that this time as well, especially in those units that are not part of the Republican Guards or the Special Republican Guards. They are relatively poorly, based on our standards, recruits. I don't have an expectation that they will fight to the last man. It is one of those things that I believe has been concentrated with the run-up to this conflict, and that is the psychological operations that have been ongoing for a number of months, and with the leaflet policies that have been given to them as well.
Kevin's on the line. Welcome, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hello, yes. Von Clausewitz on war and his work, one of the most important things he talks about is friction. When a war is prosecuted, these unforeseen things, these little hindrances that slow things down, that they turn war into something that no one can predict. And I'm wondering that just two factors, the context in which this war is being waged, or probably going to be waged very soon, world opinion and international law. It seems that there's not a country on the planet where the populace is in favor of this, even in Israel, if you include the you know, the 3 million Palestinians in the occupied territories. Even Israel, the populace, is not in favor of this. And
it's a big if. I'm referring to Israel, but never mind.
Yeah, but then in international law, you know, the idea that you know, we're not facing the imminent threat, Iraq is, and we don't have a Security Council backing. The idea that this is seen, and I think legitimately, is potentially as a war of aggression.
So Kevin, you're getting at what that kind of aggregate friction, to use von Clausewitz's term, might mean for U.S. military efforts here. Let me put that, and thank you for your call, let me put that, if I may, to Steve Van Evra. Steve, we've all seen the demonstrations in many parts of the world. We've seen the explicit commitments within the U.N. and the Security Council opposing and to oppose this military action. Does that all amount to a factor in what's about to unfold here, militarily?
No, I don't think so. I think that this war will succeed or fail based on the long-run take that the world makes of it. Does the war – do we wage the war in a way that looks legitimate to the world? When the dust settles, does it look like our purposes are legitimate? And there are going to be two questions there. One is, do we find weapons of mass destruction?
Mm-hmm.
That's crucial. If we don't, we're going to look bad. But if we do, this war is going to gain a lot of legitimacy. The second is human rights in Iraq. I think the world public is going to learn a lot about Saddam's appalling conduct after the war when we conduct the trials. Hopefully, if we're smart, we'll conduct trials that we invite the press to, and everyone will get a good look of
all the details.
Yeah, all the details, which are going to be truly horrifying. And my real worry is, well, in the short run, I think there are things that can go wrong militarily in this war that will stretch it out, lead to more civilian casualties.
What are you most worried about?
A battle for Baghdad. Earlier, General Olson was talking about, will the Republican Guard and the Special Republican Guard fall apart? If they don't, then they can invest themselves in Baghdad, hold themselves up, and make a lot of trouble. And what do we do at that point? Do we have to fight our way in? Can they arrange a battle in which we have to take losses fighting in a city and in which we have to close so close to them that they can use chemical weapons, and most importantly, can they force us to kill civilians? And, you know, Al Jazeera will put every foot of that on TV.
It'll be right there.
Right. That's a worry. Mm-hmm. And then I'm most worried of all about the long run, about how we handle this country afterward.
Under a U.S. occupation,
yeah,
and after.
Yeah. Do we know what we're doing in the post-war here? Are we going to prevent a civil war? That's the first major question. How are we going to deal with the Kurdish conflict with everyone else in that country? Very serious conflict. Are we going to keep the Turks from coming in and fighting with the Kurds? Are we going to contain the incredible amount of desire for vengeance you have in this country? After all the killing that's happened, you're going to see a huge amount of vengeance killing. If that gets out of control, it's going to drive the whole population back to warlordism. Everyone in the country is going to want a warlord to protect them.
Some overarching arm of protection. General Olstrom, how about it? The U.S. military says it's very prepared for this, for what we are about, it appears, to see. But Steve Van Evra points out this could devolve into urban warfare. And then, of course, there's the long aftermath of taking Baghdad with all those possibilities. Is the military prepared for all that?
The answer is the military is prepared for the urban warfare piece. But I'm not so sure that, as Stephen had mentioned, the world is prepared for a delay or a long period of time to accomplish this, because it is not something that can be done very quickly.
Urban warfare, taking
urban
Baghdad.
Warfare, correct. Let me add one other point to that, because as we talk about the Republican Guards, the Special Republican Guards, as we could envision them enmassing, or let's say not enmassing, but spreading out, if you would, within the civilian community,
mm-hmm.
I think there's a part of that plays into our hands, because anytime you spread them out, you lack communications. And I think communications is going to be the key to quick termination of this by cutting off the leadership from their forces.
But you raise an interesting new prospect there about the possibility of guerrilla war. We'll come back and talk about that. We're looking at the president's speech tonight. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about the president's address to the nation and the world, especially Iraq, tonight, giving Saddam Hussein and his sons 48 hours to leave the country or face military intervention, an invasion. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What did you think of the president's speech tonight? I'm joined in the studio by General Tad Olstrom, retired Air Force general, now director of national security programs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He was executive officer to the commander at the U.S. military headquarters in Europe during the Gulf War in 1991, and by Stephen Van Evra, professor of political science at MIT, and by our own Jack Beatty. Pat's calling right now from Menominee, Wisconsin. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Number one, I think the president's speech was pretty moving. I think he laid out a pretty good case.
Convincing case for you.
Yes.
Yep.
At least for me.
Yep.
But here's a scenario that I haven't heard anybody address, and I'd like to hear what the general had to think about this. After the Gulf War of 91, you know, we told the Iraqi people to rise up and to overthrow the government, and they did. Unfortunately, we weren't there to help them.
In parts, the Shia and the Kurds,
right,
and they were
exactly.
crushed.
What about, and has anybody given any serious thought to the fact that once the American troops put their feet on soil, and the Iraqi people, who are probably quite mad at Saddam Hussein, just may rise to the occasion and overthrow this thing a lot faster than we think is going to happen? I've got a feeling that's going to be the scenario. I got a feeling that a lot of the Iraqi citizens are going to say, okay, they're here, they're coming.
Let's take this into our own
exactly.
hands.
Exactly. And I got a feel, but nobody's addressed that yet. Does anybody feel that other than myself? And I'll listen to you off the air.
Great. Thanks for your call, Pat. Let's ask General Olstrom. Well, what about it? First, the straightforward question. It happened before. President Bush the first said, rise up, and people did in Iraq. Civilians did. Could that be a factor in this military action?
I do believe it is. It is a factor and will be a factor in certain areas. I think we're going to find people that will want to take some type of revenge, if you would. Stephen mentioned it earlier before the last break that this was a concern of his. I do believe it's a concern not only because it might mean Shias against other factions.
The ethnic groups within Iraq could set to fighting one another.
Or the Kurds. But I think there is a potential there that civilians might be willing to bring retribution upon other elements of either the military or some form of government. But at the same token, I don't believe that this is a likely scenario.
I want to ask just to clarify something you said just before the war, that the Republican Guard might decide to sort of put on their civvies and spread out within the population. You described that as advantageous in that they could no longer communicate with one another. Have you heard? Do you expect? Is there the possibility of a long-term guerrilla war within Iraq? When you talk about armies melting into civilian populations, of course, that raises old images of Vietnam. Is that a threat here?
I don't think in the classic guerrilla terms. The units that we're talking about, whether the Republican Guards or Special Republican Guards, number one, they aren't trained to do that. Guerrilla units are trained over a number of years to be able to operate without communications or very few communications. I do believe that the strength of an Iraqi attack or an Iraqi counterattack mm-hmm. would be based on a pure communication chain, really, with the headquarters, with the leadership, probably with Saddam, and that will be key to their effectiveness. And if that is allowed to break down, I believe that their effectiveness in terms of fighting, even in the streets, is very minimized.
Bob's calling from Boston. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Everyone's assuming that there's going to be this battle for Baghdad. Would the U.S.'s strategy potentially be to lay siege and form a horseshoe-type corridor around Baghdad would potentially be an out for those who want to surrender?
Mm-hmm. And just leave the kind of distilled opposition there? It's a great question, Bob, and I've wondered about that myself. Stephen Van Evra?
I think Bob's exactly right. That's what we're going to do. We're going to surround the city, and then we're going to dicker with commanders in the city, prying their forces apart by offering a deal to one guy, offering a deal to another guy, letting each of them know we're talking to the other one. And I think the odds are good that we'll be able to corrode the whole all the forces in Baghdad by sieging and talking. That's what I hope will happen, and I think it probably will happen. You know, the scary scenario is it doesn't work, and lots of months go by, and we don't get into Baghdad.
General Ulstrom, what do you anticipate around Baghdad? Will it be urban warfare, fighting block to block, or is there another strategy that's going to unfold here?
I think the block to block strategy would be the last thing that we would want to do in Baghdad, and I agree certainly with Stephen that I think we're going to get large-scale defections once they split up.
In other words, surround the city and offer, I don't know, an exit, safe passage, money, no prosecution for commanders who bring their troops out.
You got to remember, I think, our focus early on in this conflict is going to be to isolate the leadership and then take out the leadership. Once the leadership is gone, I do believe that the military will collapse very quickly.
How big a challenge to isolate the leadership in Iraq? We've been told for many years that Saddam Hussein was a very, very difficult guy to find.
I would say that this is high risk, but I would also say that this is where the emphasis has been put, I believe, in the intelligence, and the emphasis has been put in the targeting that during the early phases of this conflict, that's where the emphasis will be, but there is a lot of risk.
So put yourself in the other side's shoes for a moment. What countermeasures might the Iraqis, might we expect that they might consider that would foil the U.S. plans for Baghdad?
Well, in my mind, one of the real risks to this entire thing is that Saddam successfully hides for a long period of time, whether that is a week or two or three. And that essentially will disrupt much of what we are trying to do because we do not know where he's at, yet he was one of our primary targets.
So it would actually disrupt the military operation or just it would make impossible closure?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. It would force us into a position to make the decision on how to handle the urban part because at that particular time our forces will have surrounded Baghdad and we are forced then to bring that to some kind of closure because that's where we're at.
Jack Beatty, the drive to Baghdad, it generally gets presented as relatively uneventful here, though always with the proviso that there could be chemical or biological weapons along the way. But we heard Tom Ricks with the Washington Post the other night say the military's response to that is to step on the accelerator to blow through that contaminated area and actually go faster. But once the city is found, well, dickering, does that sound like a way to you? And must we have Saddam and have him soon to have a sense of cohesive invasion?
Well, I hadn't thought about that, getting Saddam as a war aim. Of course, Secretary Rumsfeld says, it doesn't matter as long as the regime is gone. But I do think that there's going to be a feeling that if he isn't found, either dead or alive, that in some sense there's a qualification around. But, you know, the trouble with the siege scenario is it can't go on too long without itself really hurting the civilian population. Because, of course, you've got to have food and so on, everything going into the city. All that will be disrupted. There's a limit to how long you can hold a modern city under siege and without provoking a huge humanitarian crisis. I just wanted to return a moment to a point that Steve made, which was about how we behave and how the world looks at us to behave. Today's Wall Street Journal says that, here's how we're going to behave. We're going to behave after the war is over through crony capitalism. We're not going to use the UN or the NGOs or CARE to deal with refugees and deal with problems. No, we're going to have Republican campaign contributors like Bechtel and Brown and Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton that gave a $34 million handshake to Bill Cheney. We're going to have them getting the contracts and doing all the work. We're going to sort of do it on the crony capitalist side. Well, I mean, even going in, that looks repulsive.
You're talking about private contractors who would be contracted to help or to take the lead in rebuilding Iraq.
Yeah, in lieu of the UN and these NGOs.
Stephen Everett, this administration likes to work through private enterprise. Is that a deal killer with the world if the UN does not take the lead in rebuilding Iraq, if it's Brown and Root and Bechtel instead?
I think we want to put a UN cover on this occupation. We don't want this to make it look like an American, Caesar has been installed there. I further think the administration has to put the highest level attention on keeping this occupation clean. The whole problem with intervening in foreign lands is that the people you send there to run the show aren't accountable to the people they're serving. And as a result, it's an inherently highly corruptible thing.
That is, U.S. officers who end up being in charge of a whole country or areas of it are not accountable to the Iraqis under them,
exactly.
Ultimately.
And we all know that people in the end misbehave when they're not held accountable. So occupations are inherently corruptible activities. And we've made some work, like the occupation of Japan and Germany. But we've had a lot of others that didn't work, that really in the end got corrupted. We found ourselves being manipulated by local actors. We found lobbyists in Washington in the end coming for their, you know, piece of the pie, the way that Jack is talking about Bechtel doing it. And all of this, to avoid this, we have to have the highest level presidential attention to this occupation.
I wanted to ask about weapons of mass destruction. General Ulstrom, you said that the military would like to come up with them. We know, obviously, for political reasons, the administration would like to hold them up. Do you believe, do we know where they are now? Do we know where to go to find them? George Bush continued to say, and the administration right up until today, that there are large quantities, they're very dangerous, that's the reason we have to go in. Is that the smoking gun we have to produce, or one of the smoking guns to justify this post invasion? Do we have to unveil the anthrax dump, the VX warehouse? Is that critical here?
I do believe that it is critical. It's critical to the pace at which we can recover not only Iraq, but also recover, I think, our strength within the world. So whether or not it can be done quickly, I think, is pretty darn important. Now, whether or not we actually find the weapons or if we find the signs of weapons, they could be buried weapons, it could be some documentation, but my own personal opinion is that we have to come up with something.
I'd say another, this is the second reason we have to come up with something, because I think Saddam for sure does have chemical and biological weapons. He wouldn't have gone to all this trouble to frustrate inspections if he didn't. And it's essential that we get our hands on these weapons before they are transferred to other hands. One of the dangers of this war is by smashing apart Iraq, we're smashing apart the structure.
The container, so they go out on a truck as we come in.
You bet, and Al-Qaeda will be very glad to get hold of them.
Jane's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Jane. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I have a nephew serving in the Persian Gulf now, poised to be deployed into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I hold George Herbert Walker Bush responsible for this, for normalizing relationships with Iraq during the Reagan-Bush administrations. And to the general's point about finding weapons of mass destruction through this operation and how that will somehow get the world opinion behind us if we can find that cache of weapons, I don't buy it. Because if we find a cache of weapons of mass destruction, I know, and my family knows, that it was George Herbert Walker Bush who supplied it to them.
But, Jane, do you think the world, the country, would be a safer place if your nephew and the others with him tonight, now preparing to go into war, did not go in and implement regime change in Iraq?
I think that the world would have been a much safer place if the Reagan-Bush administration did not create a monster.
We've got it, Jane. Thanks for your call. Steve Enevro, how about the charge? Are we cleaning up our own mess here?
Well, to some extent, yes. You know, the press has reported recently the astounding news that Iraq's biological weapons starter samples came from the United States and France, most of them from the United States. This is amazing that under the Reagan administration, we were shipping bioweapons to Iraq.
Anthrax in test tubes.
Yep.
And off it went. General Ulstrom, final thoughts tonight. We just have a few seconds left. But the military, U.S. military's likely degree of confidence tonight that this will go relatively well.
I certainly agree that it will go relatively well. One thing I'd brought up in a conversation earlier was this issue of another highway of death potential as we maybe surround the Republican Guards, the divisions that are furthest away from Iraq.
In other words, the huge destruction of Iraqi troops that we saw at the end of their withdrawal from Kuwait by American warplanes.
And in our attempt to cut them off and prevent them from retreating back to Baghdad, it may necessitate something very similar to that. And we're going to have to figure out how to deal with it, both from
militarily advantageous, but a tough PR problem.
And a very, very tough PR problem.
Well, Jack Beatty, here we are at the end of a long road. It now appears that war is truly imminent.
Yes, and the general leaves us with the thought that we could lose by winning. That's one of the paradoxes of the action we're engaged in because of its political dimension. That if the war goes on too long, that there are too many slaughters, if too many civilians die, the very fact of our winning can cause our long-term defeat.
So now we must hope to win in the largest sense, where Iraq can win. General Tad Olstrom, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Steve Van Evra, professor of political science at MIT, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.